Thanks for listening to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. You can contact the show at twitter.com/DW Groovecast and through Facebook at facebook.com/Drummer's Weekly Groovecast.
Good evening.
I am warning you right now, if you touch my drums, I will stab you in the neck with a knife.
Ain't a fucking.
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind you playing it, but lower it.
Well, we get straight out?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean.
Nice! Little trouble there. You're rushing.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah!
Hello, folks. Welcome to the Armageddon version of the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. Yes, we are recording this a mere 10 hours after, one, John and I both had gigs on Wednesday night, and two, the Cubs won the World Series.
Crazy.
We'll see you guys on the other side of oblivion.
I'm dragging butt, but we got to do what we got to do.
We got to do what we got to do, guys. Yeah, but it's a happy Thursday here, but you guys are going to be knowing this as a Monday. So we've got a few goodies in store for you on this trick-or-treat edition, this Armageddon edition of the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. So, yeah, we're...
What are we going to call this show post-election? Wow.
Man, I'm telling you, the only thing that's left is we got to have a full moon, I suppose, right?
No kidding.
Yeah. But, guys, yeah, thanks for listening as always. We've had a wonderful run of shows, and we look forward to bringing you more. Also, I would like to say that the response to my ham-fisted pumpkin carving has been incredibly gratifying. Thank you, guys. I appreciate that. You know, I got so much love for my, we'll call it the Groove Cast-a-Lantern and the Gretch-a-Lantern, that it kind of makes me doubt my career path.
Well, I kind of had a little heads up from your wife. She was bragging on your skills, and I admittedly kind of rolled my eyes like, yeah, pumpkin carving, whatever. And sure enough, you like threw those at me. I'm like, oh, man.
I'm glad I didn't disappoint.
You did a fine job, sir.
Yeah. Well, the only thing is, John, is it gets to the point that after you do a few good ones, after that, the pressure is on, and then you got to come up with something better for next year. So the 2017 Halloween jack-o'-lantern is, I'm already fielding suggestions, so please let me know what I need to do.
You can hold off on that for a while.
I'm gonna carve John's face into next year's pumpkin.
No.
So anyway, guys, not that you need it, because you guys are getting in touch with us. We appreciate it. But you can always, of course, reach us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. You can also tweet us if, again, you're a fellow or a lady who likes to speak in 140 characters or less, at twitter.com/DW Groovecast. And the old traditional standby email, drummersweeklygroovecast@gmail.com. So, happy trick or treat. We've got a treat for you today. We're going to do a topic that's kind of a combination topic. We're going to talk about click track use and reliance, along with some in-ear monitor goodies. They kind of go hand in hand, John.
Mm-hmm. They definitely, one is much better in using a click track, that's for sure. The in-ear system has made life much easier for us, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, if you recall, when we were talking with Scott Meter, he, back in the glory days of the arena touring thing, he was using a click sometimes through a wedge. That's barbaric.
That is just scary.
I mean, I'm glad we drug ourselves out of the tar pits, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, we've touched on click track in the past, and, you know, it's certainly become a regular and almost required thing in most gigs. And I had a conversation with a couple prominent drummers in recent years that kind of surprised me, but at the same time, I'm like, yeah, I get it. And that is that, you know, one of them said, man, every gig I do, just about, it's like 90% of it's click tracks, you know, like no matter what, you know, it's just become a thing that is just part of the landscape of gigging now. And for drummers, you know, that's something that you just kind of have to embrace. And he said, I did a gig the other night and there was no click track. And I kind of found myself from time to time questioning my, you know, time and all that, and realizing like, wow, I really use that as a crutch or rely on it or even just not think about it. And I was thinking like, you know, I get that. There's times when I could see that happening. You're not feeling great on a gig, you know, physically, you're a little out of sorts. Like my gig last night was kind of like that. I just didn't, nothing was really flowing. And that's when things creep in your head. But sure enough, man, it the best of the best, you know, there's going to be days like that where you're kind of second guessing yourself. And I decided maybe it's cool to touch on some of this stuff and not only address it, but maybe come up with some solutions to avoid it.
Well, you know, you and I have had this conversation before where we talk about where we say, it's our job as drummers to provide good feeling time to everybody. But you get into this weird kind of push and pull thing where, okay, I need to concentrate on what I'm playing, right? I need to concentrate on the time. I've got to provide good feeling time to these other musicians. But then you don't want to get that too much into your head. And then all of a sudden you're concentrating too much on it. And so in other words, what's the balance, right? Mm-hmm. What's the balance between, you know, you've got to provide good time versus, okay, now time is in my head and it's almost like you're too focused on it.
Oh, I think we all are guilty of that more than we want to admit, you know, because it's been driven into our head for so long, time. And I don't know, you know, I've definitely come from the camp, like, I love for a bridge to lift or a solo section to lift a little, but then settling back in and all that. And a lot of that has to do with either naturally good time or experience and being able to do that. The reality is, you know, clicks are just a really major part of our performance, a lot of us. And you know, there's still the old dinosaur that's just like, I don't want to use a click, and, you know, and there's the other part of it, like, I can't hear it and all that. And,
right.
You know, if you're playing with your buds in some band you played together for 25 years and all that, and you use monitors and it's all cool, you know, but if you're seriously, and a lot of younger guys are probably just rolling their eyes like, duh, yeah, click track, whatever, but right, it's just a reality in the modern world of music and live performance, especially, that it's become prominent.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of the things that I'm going to say today, and probably a lot of the points we're going to make today, are going to have some roots in that episode 3 that I did about, you know, we're going to kind of harken back and talk a little bit about some of the uses of click tracks versus what we're going to concentrate on today is like what we can see or what we consider to be the reliance part of it. And then how you can kind of wrap your mind around it from the standpoint of like, well, yeah, we do use it a whole lot, but we don't want to be relying on it, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, we want to use it for the tool that it is, right? And not use it as a crutch. Use it as a tool, but not a crutch. There's a little bit of a difference there.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, sometimes you get in that mindset where like you're bulletproof because you have that. No one can, you know, and that's not a good place to be. My experience and how I've kind of addressed that insecurity that we've all had from time to time, like, oh, am I there's no click. Am I really holding it together and all that? On my regular gig, I make it a point to, I'd say 30% of the tunes, I just don't use a click at all.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, it's like, you know, older R&B tunes or a Beatles song or something like that where, you know, it's just let it be, play, you know, and a lot of that was recorded that way too. So, you know, we all kind of experienced drummers, especially, you know, we're in that zone counting off tunes where it's going to be pretty close, pretty consistent. But that's one way that I've gotten past, you know, not just like, oh, I got to have a click on everything, is just force myself to be like, nah, these set of tunes, you're counting them and you're going. And that's been a big help for me, like on a regular basis, to be pretty together, keeping it pretty together.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I do the same thing. I do the exact same thing, because it's just like you said, there are certain songs in our, you know, just in our entire vocabulary that we play, that, have you ever done this, John? Have you ever turned a click on one of the songs that you're talking about, one that you're accustomed, that you've heard a million times, and that you're accustomed to playing without a click? And then when you play your normal feel, like in other words, when you're playing your normal time and your normal tempo, a lot of times you'll go to a chorus or you'll go to a bridge and you'll put that time, or you'll put your time where you have normally been feeling it, and it rubs against the click.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It'll either fall behind or jump up a little bit on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an excellent, you know, thing to your point that you're saying there, is that, you know, if you do play it to a click sometimes, you can kind of look at it from a standpoint of like, well, you know, when I play it without a click, I'm kind of being true to the genre, so to speak.
Yeah, I think so. I, you know, look, I mean, obviously on all the modern stuff we do, on some of that just straight funk tunes, you know, I'm using a click because it just creates what needs to be, which is that just locked down, almost quantized, almost edited vibe, you know, like, and it makes perfect sense. But I really think, like, Respect, for example, I played that song for 30 years, and it's just playing it with it to a click is just kind of a drag, man. That song needs to have its ebb and flow. And we're talking minor, you know, things here, but there's just, like you said, certain genres just kind of lend to, let's just play this. And in turn, it's allowing you to kind of stay in touch with that approach of not playing with a click. And, you know, if you do get into some of that second guessing mindset, which, again, we're all capable and guilty of. One thing that I do really regularly is on songs I do have a click, I might just bag the click for a while.
Yeah.
And then pull it back up. And, you know, I'm pretty confident in my time. It's all good. And I'd say, and I have witnesses to this in case anyone wants to, but, you know, I'd say probably 90% of the time, you know, it's pretty much dead on or right in it, right, just falls right in. And that in itself, man, talk about a confidence boost. You know, for a chorus, a solo, and a bridge, I'm not even using the click. And then the outro, I go back up and check. And, you know, every once in a while you'll see a couple guys smiling, you know, that's because I'm doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we have to be confident. We have to be secure in our abilities, and anything you can do to help that is there. And there's something that works for me.
Right. Well, something that I'll do from time to time that will also kind of give you a little bit of confidence in playing with a click, and also realizing that you don't necessarily have to be a slave to it and be reliant to it, is what we talked about before, is go ahead and when you are playing through a verse and go to a chorus, make it lift. In other words, get on top of it just a little bit. If you want to give it just a little bit of a rise, or give it some type of a tempo push, like that. Manipulate the click a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, and then do the old thing of fall back just a hair back into it when you go back to a verse. So in other words, some click manipulation, that in itself, man, is a bit of a boost to get you, again, not necessarily reliant on a click, but get you to the point to where you can manipulate it.
Now, let me ask you, if you were to,
yes,
hypothetically,
yes,
ride the top of a click in, yes, a song, are you able to like reel back in some strong-willed players if they decide that they want to continue in that trend? Or
John, you're assuming these strong-willed players are listening anyway.
That's a fine point. Wait a minute. I was lost in a dream there. Everyone had a mix of other people. Yeah, sorry. Let's move on.
Yeah. So, yeah. But again, when you're doing this, when you're kind of manipulating a click, you're talking about infinitesimal amounts of beat movement.
Of course. Yeah. It can't, by default, you can't go too far.
Right. Exactly.
One way or the other.
And you know, if you wanna also speak directly to the drummers just for a second regarding like what actually moves, or for me, what actually moves whenever I'm talking about that, it's primarily my hands that move up a little bit. In other words, I normally try to keep the kick, keep that bass drum right on it, and then, you know, move the backbeat up a tad bit and or back a tad bit.
Right.
So it's more of the hands that move anyway. So you're telling me that a vocalist is going to notice that?
No. But I'll tell you this. Like if you're in a regular gigging situation, like say you're in a band that plays regularly, you know, a couple times a week, you're doing you know, set amount of tunes or, you know, certain tunes, all that. One thing I have noticed with a click that's been awesome, like an example is September by Earth, Wind & Fire. For 20 years, we've done that at 123 BPM. For 20 years. And I play to a click on that tune. And I promise you, not only would I more than likely count it off just blindly at 123, but that band, if it started at 125 or 121, that band is just going to end up at 123 because of the muscle memory of using that same tempo and that click for all those years. And that's a really cool thing when you're talking about, you know, a band and a chemistry and all that. That's just an added, just, you know, advantage that band's going to have in that sense. But I'm not kidding you. We've done songs forever at the same tempo, and that whole thing can benefit there, and you can benefit from that. And it's an incredible observation if you really pay attention to it.
You know, it's funny. It's not like that is not an example of click track reliance as much as it is. That's almost like click track memorization or tune. It's almost like song and tempo memorization or sort of like a convergence.
Yeah.
To where those two things, they just become ingrained.
That's true. And, you know, I mean, you could call it that. I kind of call it, it's kind of like dog training, you know, just subtly being the master manipulator. And
Pavlov's band.
There you go. You know, but maybe not if anyone's listening that could be victim of that.
Yeah. All right.
But it is incredible how there, you, as you pointed out, you know, an example of not being reliant, but benefiting in musically in a way that tool, which we talked about, is really benefiting a band, and that there's not three rhythm section players kind of swimming around. It's like, man, just locked.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing has paid dividends for the band I play in for sure, because it's just tighter than tight can be with the added focus of that kind of thing, besides some great players. It's just really, it's really beneficial.
I can attest, I have worked with said band.
Pretty, yes. I mean, in my band, if you're a drummer and you come and sit in, it's like, if you pay attention, you're going to kill.
Yeah.
Because they're just so good. It's crazy.
So, John, kind of along that line, as far as like, do you have any particular suggestions regarding our listeners practicing with a click and or without a click that could help them from the standpoint of not being totally reliant on, in other words, not having to have a click throughout?
Well, I know when I was younger, I did some exercises where I would do like 4 bars of click, 4 bars without, and there'd be a loop.
Yep.
And you're just trying to just lock into that. And the one thing I learned, in some ways it was the hard way, but I learned to focus more on my body and the flow of my body than like, oh, there's the click, 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 click. It's like, just get in this motion with your body. And I do that a lot when I'm playing now, like, you know, just locking in a verse where I'm more focused on like just the consistency of my entire body. And that creates that groove and that time. But you know, like 4 bars on, 4 bars. I used to take a drum machine and do that. And I programmed that. That's one thing. Another thing is just really trying to, remember that, you know, you can't sacrifice feel and touch. And I think many drummers that in recent years that played for a long time without a click and without in-ears and now do regularly might tell you like, yeah, I feel like my touch is has suffered a little bit.
Interesting.
And I think there's some validity to that too. So, you know, just be aware when you're practicing with a click that, you know, there's still technique and touch and sound and all that you ultimately should be focused on as well, because that's going to set you apart from a guy who's just bashing along, even if he can play perfect time. If that snare drum is not consistent or doesn't sound great, or that you're just crushing toms and they're just choking out, you know, all those things, it's good to be aware of that when you're practicing.
Absolutely. And to go ahead and kind of embolden your points on that, another thing that I've done that is part of your practice, where you were talking about how you would have a click, you would have something programmed where you'd have 4 bars of click and then 4 bars of just empty space before the click starts over again. Of course, you can always do different lengths of time. You can do 2 bars, 4 bars, 8 bars, 16 bars, or whatever. Naturally, the more empty
16.
Bars.
16.
Naturally, the more empty bars, the more difficult it's going to be. But something that I found that was extremely beneficial, and I believe that this is where a lot of the root problems come from people when they become reliant upon it or they feel like they need it, is every time we play a song, it is very seldom that we play a song where the groove never changes. In other words, to where either the bass drum pattern stays consistent and never changes, or either the subdivision with our hands, whether we're playing 16th notes on one part, eighth notes on another part. It almost always changes, right?
Go to the ride.
Exactly, go to the ride cymbal. That even if you play eighth notes on the hat and then you go to eighth notes on the ride, it creates a different feel,
definitely.
Right? So what I would do is I would do the same thing where I'd have either a 4 or 8 bar click and then 4 or 8 bars of just silence before it would start over again. I would make sure that when the click part ended, I would do a kind of a transition, and then I would change the subdivision or change the groove, because a lot of times that's where the rub becomes. In other words, where people lose confidence in what they're playing is that it changes, the groove changes, and therefore you feel like that your time changes or where you place the beat changes to the detriment of the song. So that helped me out.
Great.
A good bit. You know,
great advice,
doing that.
Man.
Yeah.
And I'm still like, I just play the same beat, and if I end up on the, I'm happy. So In other words, I'm not going to try that because I don't I don't need at this point in my life to just fold up in a fetal position. So you young whippersnappers take Phil's advice and I'll stick to my
The next guns. Podcast is going to be called Beat Reliance. Playing the same one over and over again. But you know, John, one other thing I was going to say is I love that thing you were talking about how when you were playing with it that you were feeling, literally feeling your motions, your body motion, feeling it from your gut, feeling it from your arms, because something that is not really discussed and talked about enough is that we play an acoustic instrument that we strike, that we have to make motions mm-hmm. to actually play. And the shape of our motions, the fluidity of our motions, just the overall arc, the overall motion of the motions create the sound that we're going to get and the time feel that we get. And, you know, if you are restricting those motions or if you're making small jabby motions, you're going to get stabby, jabby kind of sounds, which in a lot of ways is to the detriment of a lot of grooves, unless that's what you're, of course, trying to do,
sure.
You know, at that time. But yeah, the fluidity and the space between the notes that you make with your motions helps define that groove and helps define the time.
Oh, yeah. I think that might be the most overlooked physical aspect of playing, in that we're so locked into the velocity or the... Mm-hmm. The you know how we're hitting the snare drum or how we're playing the ride cymbal or the consistency of our foot and all this, and like the motion of your body can be overlooked so often. And I mean, it's not by accident that a lot of drummers you see that just really are flowing and look incredibly natural and just kind of one with their instrument resonate with you, because mm-hmm. They're just either have focused on or naturally have that motion as part of their overall thing. And I think when I really started recording more, I started paying a lot more attention to motion, because like I'd want that verse to be consistent. It could be like, you know, something like that. Man, every one of them, I wanted it to be, you know, that open hi-hat coming down on four, mm-hmm. like just to be seamless, flowing, you know, consistent thing. And I realized motion was a big part of it. And motion, of course, can create feel too, versus, you know, old school funk straight eighth, just right. hammered out versus a slinky, you know, Rick Murata kind of thing. You know, there's motion is a big part of all of that.
Right. And For folks that get into their head, like we talked about before, that always feel like they're having problems with their time, whether they're playing with a click or not, that is part of, and this goes back to like that episode that I did, that episode 3, where a lot of times you get so focused on everything but the feel and the sound of the groove.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we mean by you get too much into your head. In other words, it could be a variety of things. It could be the whole thing of restricting motions, you know, to try to be almost too consistent, mm-hmm. or try to do that whole thing where you're listening so much to the click that you're not even hearing yourself. That happens all the time, man.
Yeah, it's so easy to get in that place.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, man, I'll share an experience with you. I did a record where a really great bass player from Nashville came, was on the session, and we were playing, and it was one of those days where we were knocking out, you know, we were trying to get some stuff done, and there was one tune where I just felt like I wasn't really locked, and I said something to him like, man, I'm really sorry, man, I just feel like I could be a little more, and he's like, man, that's just overrated sometimes. I just did a session with Eddie Bears the other day, and he was all over the place. We took out the click, and it felt like $1 million. You know, let's look at the big picture here. Mm-hmm. You know, is it working or not musically? And I think it's kind of along, like, burying the click being able to do that is a good thing. Like if you're playing with some loops or something like that, mm-hmm. but sometimes it might not be the be all and end all on a song, or it might be that there's some ebb and flow with the musicians. It's making it human and all that. It's kind of along the lines of like the myth of, you know, oh man, session guys, they can just read something down one take and it's over. Well, no, sorry. You know, I mean, you're going to tell me like Carl Stallings, you know, back in the day, these guys just read it down perfectly. It was right. No, I've heard recorded proof that they don't do it perfect every time because they don't. And so that myth, along with, man, if you can't bury a click, you're never going to be. And it's like, that's not necessarily true.
Oh, I think it's absolutely untrue. I think it's absolutely, and you just, I've heard that exact same story about, as a matter of fact, it was about Eddie Bears, about how, you know, when you put Eddie with the click, of course he was playing with the click, mm-hmm. but it was, there was ebb and flow all the way through it. You pull the click out and it's brilliance. It
sounds incredible.
So yeah. is that not a testament enough from the standpoint of don't play target practice with the click?
Right.
I mean, it leads to all kinds of, I call them time anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the type thing where if you feel yourself getting a little behind or if you feel yourself getting ahead, our brains are such incredibly magnificent tools that we can literally, in between clicks at fast tempos, overcorrect. You know, I mean, it's amazing. You overcorrect and it creates these little humps or these little jerks
yep.
inside of the time. And that's one of the things that I hear from either students or I've heard from other players. I told that little brief story on that same episode that we talk about, that one of the first times that it really kind of crystallized in my mind was, there was a buddy of mine had recorded this record and he had brought it to me. And he goes, man, I want you to listen to this thing. And I said, yeah, I can't wait to hear it. And he goes, man, I'm not happy with it. And I mean, what do you mean? And they had spent a ton of money on it too. And there was a fairly famous producer that worked on it here. They gave him a bunch of money to do it. And he goes, he said, I played with a click, but it doesn't sound like it. And I'm weirded out by the whole thing. And at first I kind of thought that maybe that's a cool thing, but I understood what he was talking about. It was in his head so much that he was reliant on, oh, I've got to bury the click, that when he felt himself straying a little bit from it, he was overcorrecting, and it created those little humps. And so you have to get out of the mindset that you're a slave to the click. Really, what you have to do is you have to embrace that click as being total freedom.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you use that click as a reference, but not, you're never chasing it. You're not a slave to it. It's just a guide.
Right.
And you have to learn then that, yeah, there are times that we are going to, you know, move a little bit ahead, get a little bit behind, but you allow the natural ebb and flow of your playing to get you back to where you need to be. Whether if you're, again, pushing a little bit, you lay back a little bit, or vice versa. If you have to go to a course and lift it a little bit, you allow the natural ebb and flow of it. Because it sounds strange to just make a quick jump, boom, and go from beat four to count one, and all of a sudden you're right on top of it. There's a natural ebb and flow that has to come from naturally a bar at before that you're starting to creep up a little bit, and then even use your drum fill to set that up
mm-hmm.
to get to the point to where, hey, I'm going to play that drum fill just a little bit on the edge, and therefore it'll kind of set me up to do that, to play a little bit more on top when I get to a chorus or a bridge or whatever.
Yeah, I've had to, I tend to drag my fills typically, and I had to be really aware of that. And it made a huge difference, just like, hey, you know, and almost like I felt like I was almost rushing, but not, you know, just,
yeah.
And that would set up the next section. Well, one thing I'd be remiss in not mentioning is, if you're using a click live or especially in the studio, if you're rehearsing something, turn that baby on.
Yeah.
because, man, there's nothing more miserable than like blazing through something while you're rehearsing and it's 4 or 5 BPM faster, and then they hit record and you're all of a sudden it's 96 instead of 100 BPM and you're just back there sucking.
Well, or in my case, it's 124 and you were practicing it at 160.
Yeah, that just is into, like, you know, needing therapy at that point. But always, you know, like when we learn, you know, like sometimes we have to learn a song on a gig, and if it's just a one-off tune, man, I got that click going from the word go. Even if they're like, hey, man, let's just do that chorus real quick. I want to make sure I get, I'm like, hold on, you know, because it's just, it's sheer misery if you don't. So something to be mindful of with rehearsing and versus performance.
Yeah, my little quick story on that was, and let me say this, it was myself and some other veterans that were in the studio, and we all just, man, we just blew it, was what it was we were doing a 15-second TV spot, and the charts were on the stands, and we were just in there kind of messing around, and somebody said, hey, let's just run this real quick. And I mean, we blasted through that thing at a ridiculous tempo, and instead of taking 3 minutes to record this thing with a couple of safeties, mm-hmm. you know, on top of it, you know, it took us 5 minutes to get back into the feel of where it was supposed to be. So yeah, you absolutely, when you're, especially when you're in the studio, when you're getting ready to run something for the first time, go ahead and put the click on, man. That's, you gotta do it.
Here's another trick. I remember I hearkening back to one of those days where you do 10 or 12 songs in a day. I had a session one time where I just kept playing way on top of something. It was mm-hmm. like one of those, we all have our tempo windows that are weird. Like mine's in that 80 range where I'm just like, put a gun in my mouth, please. And we're playing and I keep just getting on top and it's just a drag and all that. And so I don't know how this came to me, but it was like, I said to the producer, hey man, I need 5 minutes. So I went outside, kind of got my head together, came back in. I said, will you put that click at 75 for a minute? And I played at 75. Or no, maybe it was I the opposite. Like I was rushing. So I was like, whatever happened, I think slowing down the tempo, that was it. And I played that groove at like, you know, 5 or 6 BPM slower. Uh-huh. And then when the track came on, it just laid right in there. I did one take and it was done. I manipulated my brain into the whole idea of, I'm not locking, so I'm going to take it back or forward a little bit. And then when it came on, it just kind of fell in. That's a bizarre story, but it worked.
Well, I was going to say that in itself, I mean, that's a great technique, man.
I can't remember whether it was rushing or dragging. Yeah. I think it was rushing. And I went the opposite way. And then as soon as that click came on for the actual take, it was like effortless.
Yeah.
So there's little things you can get into like that. And, you know, it's really just me showing my humanness on every level.
Well,
80 BPM, leave me alone.
Well,
call Scott Meter.
John, one of the things we talked about at the beginning of the show was, we were saying one of the things that is actually contributing to folks that are becoming reliant on click tracks is the proliferation of in-ear monitors.
Mm-hmm.
But let me tell you, there's a whole lot more good, in my opinion, that comes from that than what we just talked about the bad aspect of it, about how it can create people to create folks becoming reliant mm-hmm. on a click. So let's talk a few minutes about how we like to use these things and the importance of being familiar with them.
Well, I think at this point, you just have to embrace the reality of in-ear monitor systems, because just about any gig of note, it's going to be inevitable. And, you know, most gigs are running clicks or running tracks and, you know, the optimum way of hearing and playing to them is going to be in ears. It looks better than a regular set of headphones. Like, there's a lot of reasons. You're also, you know, it's just something that it's allowing us to better control stage volume, you know, not necessarily with drums, but everything else, you know, vocal monitors and all these things. So there's a lot of benefits to it. For me, I think two things that I noticed early on, I've been using in-ears for a long time, but the two things I noticed early on that helped me embrace it were, one, on a big stage, like, you know, if a keyboard player is starting a tune or a guitar player is starting a tune, you know, on a big stage where it's like their amps over there and you're kind of hearing it and maybe, and the singer might be, you know.
Right, talking over it.
You know, and you're just kind of like, whoa, what in the world? And you can really lock into that. And it makes a big difference, man. It's like you're not guessing. You're not kind of in the ballpark. You're like, it's right there. And that really tightened up things for me a lot in regards to things like that where, you know, either vocal cues or someone's talking and then say, hey, hit it. You know, you hear all that. But more importantly, instrumentally, you're hearing things or, you know, horn cues. Sometimes you'll be doing a tune and the outro's got this horn riff and you know that's the outro if you're guilty of autopilot like me. So these things are just absolutely gold as far as in-ears go. You also, the other thing I noticed was, man, the fatigue factor post-gig. When I started using in-ears, you have all these SPLs that were just wearing you out for years and, you know, a stack, basically a PA just blazing at you. And it just, it's so fatiguing. So I noticed, like, when I started using ears, I felt significantly better at the end of a gig than I had when it was like a monitor just blazing. So that's another thing that's great. And, you know, some of the old school guys, oh, I don't like it. I can't hear the crowd. There's ways around that. You can have crowd mics.
Yeah.
You can, but it's something you got to just embrace. And I just think it's really been a great thing.
Well, you know, let me tell you, one of the things that when you have somebody say they feel isolated, you know what that is code word for? I don't have anybody else in my mix but me.
That's a great observation.
That's what it is. And so, you know, they've got to make sure that they have, you know, they have other people in their mix.
Yeah.
Is what it is. But one of the things I wanted to add on to the very first point that you made is that, you know, this is kind of the way things are going and that certain gigs require that now. Well, let me tell you this. It's gotten to the point, there's several reasons other than the whole thing of, like, you know, click and tracks. Naturally, you know, and that's kind of what we're basing this entire show on, you know, is the use of it because of that. But another thing is this, and this is incredibly beneficial for several other reasons, is that a lot of times a music director or a band leader will have a talk back to give direction,
right?
You know, for this, that, or the other. And one of my main gigs, we have that, whether it's somebody calling a song or it's just like, hey guys, we're just going to do this and take a break or whatever. But another thing is this, I've been doing a TV show for years where we've been using in-ear monitors on that. And of course it's for everybody in the band, in the pit for that. But the other thing is this, man, we get cues again from like TV, we're going to commercial, you know, going to commercial on this, or hold, you know, like whenever they're getting something set for the stage, we're going to hold, you know, before that. So it's a technology that you absolutely need to embrace.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there are just some gigs that you have to do it. And there are a few very high-profile gigs that I've auditioned for. One of the very first requirements, whether they email it to you or talk to you about it on the phone, is, hey, are you familiar with and do you have an in-ear system?
Mm-hmm.
You absolutely have to make that happen, and you got to get familiar with it.
And that investment's worthwhile, too. You know, get good custom-made ones. Seal is, especially behind a drum kit.
Yeah.
your seal is so important, you know, where you don't have bleed and your volume becomes an issue. It really is. Investigate. There's a lot of reasonable options, but make that investment. As a musician at this point, that's something that you really need to be aware of and
right.
and look into and have available.
Well, to the folks that don't or say they don't like them, I think that there's a few things that need to be addressed regarding just the fit and the use of them. And I think one thing that a lot of guys have problems with is when they get, let's say, universal monitors, if they're accustomed to using just, we'll say, like iPod earbuds, mm-hmm. the kinds that really don't go, especially that don't go in your ear canal, the seal aspect of what you're talking about, getting them to seal properly where you can hear what you need to hear and feel comfortable with them, is lost on them because a lot of times they just kind of set them in their ears and they don't get them seated properly in their ear canal. Mm-hmm. And what I'll tell everybody...
Then it needs to be really loud.
Exactly. They have to turn their volume up, which it really flies in the face of why you have these things anyway, mm-hmm. right? What I always tell everybody is, if you haven't used these before, these monitors, they need to be touching your brain.
Yeah, that's pretty true.
They need to be in there. And in the initial discomfort, you will get over that. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, the physical discomfort of putting them in your ears like that. But to get what you need to get out of these monitors, you need to get them in there. Now, naturally, if you're using molded custom monitors, that's not going to be an issue.
Right.
You know, in other words, they're going to be in there the way they need to be in there. But on universal monitors, when people first start out with those things, you got to get them in there and you got to get them seated properly or they're worthless.
True. Find the sleeves that work for your ears. Everybody's different sizes, different shape.
Right.
You know, that's...
Yeah. Well, one thing also that I want to touch on regarding that entire thing is there are chiefly two main kinds of monitors as far as like the way that they're built. And I'm talking about custom monitors now. Mm-hmm. I want to spend just a minute on this, okay? Pretty much if you're buying custom monitors, you're either going to get the hard acrylic kind of monitors or you're going to get the full silicone. Now, there are some acrylic monitors that the makers put like silicone ear canal pieces, the kind that go in your actual ear. But let me just say this. I've had both. Okay. And I've had a lot of other musician friends that have had both. And the initial comfort that you get from the silicone, which is, it is wonderful. I'm not going to lie. It's wonderful. And the ability to keep them in your ears for significant periods of time, it's pretty much unparalleled. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the big drawback that those things have is they really trap a lot of moisture. They trap a lot of heat. And I'm going to put the rubber where the rubber meets the road. They have a tendency to fail because they trap a lot of moisture inside of the actual ear pieces. Mm-hmm. And I would be very aware of that because I had a pair that spent more time or as much time in the shop as they did on the gig.
Sage advice. It is an investment that is not to be scoffed at. So, you know, buying the ones that are going to last and hold up and, mm-hmm. you know, everybody's different. I know I have a little more ear wax than the average person and I had a problem with that.
TMI, John.
Earwax is, it's your friend. We shouldn't be disgusted by earwax. It keeps your ears from being damaged.
What's a little wax between friends?
That's
right?
All I'm saying. I'm not serving it up to you on a cracker. Relax, man. I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, why are we so squirmy about earwax?
I've been in some green rooms where it looked like they were serving some up on a cracker.
Yeah. I hate those green rooms.
Well, the in-ear monitor aspect, again, it goes hand in hand with our topic today on
yep.
this. And yeah, if you haven't embraced it, if you haven't spent some time working with them for fear of this, that, or the other, you got to drop it and you got to move forward.
It is very important that you embrace it for sure. Do your research, make the investment, and down the road, I promise you, especially as a drummer, behind that kit, man, it is gold. You hear better. You just, everything about it makes the experience pretty awesome in a high volume setting, especially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, John, you know who never had problems with Click Track Reliance?
I know. My choice for the unappreciated drummer today.
And same as mine. John, go tell us who you got today for your great underappreciated drummer.
Well, there's a New York guy from back in the day that a friend of mine kind of asked about a record he played on a while ago, and I had forgotten because we had discussed a blues friend of mine had talked about some Elmore James records as well. And there's a guy named Belton Sticks Evans. And I think his real name's Sam, but it's always credited as Belton Evans or Sticks Evans. And he was just an incredibly well-rounded player with a really prominent career. Besides the blues stuff, he was on some real seminal blues records, Elmore James stuff, the King Curtis stuff, Big Joe Turner, Lightning Hopkins. I mean, really, top tier stuff. And besides that, he did some pretty cool jazz stuff. He did. He played with Eric Dolphy. He played with Mingus, Ornette Coleman. He's the guy who did, there was a couple, in the really early 60s, Aretha did a couple albums that were a little more jazz oriented. And he was in the trio that backed that up. A lot of people aren't aware of those records as much, but really great New York trio. I want to say Bryant, that was a piano player. He's a New York guy that had been around. Anyway, the Drifters and the Coasters stuff, big, old school R&B hits. He played on a bunch of that stuff. And I remember there's some live Sam Cooke stuff. He toured with Sam Cooke for, a number of years. I'm not quite sure about that, but I know he played on the Sam Cooke Copa record, which was Sam just killing it, and that band was smoking. And even cooler, he was Bernard Purdy's teacher. So this guy, Belton Evans, man, look him up. All Music has a great discography of stuff he did. A monster.
First, if we were to call Bernard, would he actually say he was Belton's teacher?
From my experience, I'm just going to leave that entire subject alone. I gave the props to the man who taught a legendary drummer, and I'll leave it at that.
All Bernard has to say is, "Kid Charlemagne."
That's a good point.
Or how about just Royal Scam? Hey,
rock,
man, I played on Royal
Steady.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then another thing, anybody who's named Belton, I'm good with that, man.
That's kind of like Scott Meter, just as he's born to do it. He's out there belting it out.
Belting it out. Also, how about, my gigs, I recorded with the Platters and Eric Dolphy.
Aretha. And I can gut bucket with the best of them.
Yeah. Well, sir,
that's just how it was, man. There's a lot of guys like that. Just had it together.
Man, you taught me something today. I have never heard of the guy.
Well,
never heard of him.
I want to thank my buddy Ben Thompson for kind of reintroducing me to him. I was aware of him years ago. Like I said, a big blues aficionado was going on about him. And it came back up recently, and I was like, man, this guy has got it together.
Well, I'll be doing my research after this. Yeah, man, that's great. I mean, you taught me something today.
Awesome.
So My guy today is a guy that I used to hang out with some when I was in Memphis.
I like it already.
Well, let me just say this. He was a mess, man, when I was hanging out with him.
I'm not surprised.
Back in Memphis. You could take that for however you want to take it. But
imagine how he was in 1973.
Yeah. So I'm going with a Memphis guy, if you haven't gleaned that already.
That one-horse, non-music town.
Man, a bunch of hacks over there, huh?
What have they done that's influential in Memphis?
I don't know.
Anyway, go ahead and give your props to this insignificant bum.
I'm going to bet that our listenership has probably seen this guy as much or more than they've heard him, because he was the drummer in the infamous Blues Brothers movie.
Correct.
Yeah, he was.
And the sunglass visor guy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And the drummer in question is the wonderful Willie Too Big Hall. Mm-mm-mm. Yeah, yeah. A little bit about him before we get to, because everybody, you know, now the light bulb has gone off. Oh, the Blues Brothers guy. But let me tell you a little bit about this guy. He was, as almost everybody, every drummer was, overshadowed, of course, by Al Jackson, you know, back in the day. But Too Big Hall was the drummer for the Bar K's, and he was also the drummer for Isaac Hayes. And after Al Jackson passed, he actually did a stint with Booker T and the MGs after that as well. And was when Stax was gone by the 70s, of course, but they still did, to my understanding, some live touring, you know, as like a Stax Volt review kind of a thing. And Too Big Hall did a lot of those touring things as well. But there's one record in particular that I want to talk to you about, that if this guy only did this one record, he's good to go. And it's a record that Isaac Hayes recorded back in the late 60s, like 68 or 69. It's called Hot Buttered Soul. And it is one of the nastiest, funkiest, groovinest records you'll ever hear. Of like, just, there's extreme tempo playing from the standpoint of on the slow side, man.
Oh, this,
yeah. Yeah.
Space for days.
Yeah, they did that old tune Walk On By.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's like a 20-minute version of By the Time I Get to Phoenix that's just, I mean, you could drive a truck between the beats, you know, just incredible. And then there's a tune, it's kind of funny, I hear this tune every week, sometimes multiple times a week, that this one of the bands that I play with, when we finish the night and the band plays the last song, the sound guy will put on some music through the speakers, and that song is, and let me see if I've got it written down, let me see if I can actually say it. It's called Hyperbolic Syllabic Sesquidalamistic. And it is, man, one of the funkiest gut bucket tunes, man, you'll ever hear. And Too Big Hall is killing it on there. And that's from Hot Buttered Soul, Isaac Hayes.
Yummy.
Yeah. And, you know,
man, people don't realize too how enormously successful Isaac was at this time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was just, God was on tour. You know,
Shaft, man.
It was mind-boggling.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, if you kind of want a little bit of a, I guess, a historic example of how big Isaac Hayes was, there's a movie, a documentary called Watts Stax, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they call him Black Moses.
Yep.
You know, he comes out in a chainmail shirt. He's the headliner of the show. And, I mean,
just owns it.
Owns it, man. It's unbelievable. So, yeah, my guy is Willie Too Big Hall.
Great stuff.
Yeah, he's still kicking it, man, in Memphis, yep. To my knowledge, I should say. Yes.
There's a, you know, there's, it's funny, like, Stax has such a big reputation there, but there was that High Records crew, which Willie was a part of.
Yep. But
they did a lot of stuff, man. A lot of quality stuff.
You the know. Hodges brothers, too, man. Yeah. Were involved in that.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Grimes, you know, he yes. was around quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But there's some, and God knows I'm as big an Al Jackson fan as there is on the planet, but there's some just ridiculously high quality work coming out of that besides Booker T and the MGs and the Stack stuff, and Willie was right in the middle of it.
Willie's never been click track reliant.
No, I'm thinking not.
Yeah. Well, John, any words of wisdom before we sign off for the week?
No, other than congratulations to the Chicago Cubs.
That town has had its share of like sports love and just incredible championship runs, man. The only people now that's holding things up are the Bears.
At least they won a Super Bowl.
What was it, 85?
Yeah, they won one.
Yeah.
I'm sure Cleveland would remind you they haven't.
Yeah, but I mean, between the Blackhawks were the most recent champions prior to that. And then you had the White Sox.
Wait.
Chicago's
had a World Series champion?
Unbelievable.
I don't believe it. ESPN hasn't mentioned that.
The White Sox are the proverbial New York Jets of Chicago.
The Mets.
The Islanders.
The Clippers.
Yeah, right. Well, folks, all right. Thanks for joining us. We've had a great day. We've had fun talking to you guys. We love bringing the show to you. As always, you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com, Drummers Weekly Groovecast, Twitter, twitter.com, DW Groovecast, and always Drummers Weekly Groovecast at gmail.com. We love hearing from you. We appreciate the support. Until next time, we will see you soon.
Willie, call me.
Take a Sunday spin, go and watch the Dodgers win. Have yourself a dandy day that cost you under a fin.